The Second Court of Appeals today, especially because I know the weather has been a little challenging, but glad you made it, and we're happy to be doing oral arguments again, so welcome. We have one case on our docket for 1:30, and before we begin, I will introduce the panel that you have today. To my right is Justice Dana Womack. To my left is Justice Brian Walker, and I'm Elizabeth Kerr. So if everybody's ready, I'll ask the clerk to call the case.
The court will now call Michelle McKenzie Alfred Shaw as independent interest for the estate of Robin Dell Shaw, deceased, versus Judy Nicholson individually and as personal representative of the estate of Misty Nicholson, deceased, and as guardian and next friend of LBN, a minor, Dominique Riola and Carla Riola. May I please support Mr. Stephen D. Santolico will argue for the appellant. Mr. Rick Thompson will argue for the state.
Okay.
Sorry, I believe.
May it please the court, I've reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal this afternoon. Good afternoon, Your Honor. Steve Sanfilippo for Appellant Michelle McKenzie Alfred Shaw. This is an appeal from the denial of Ms. Shaw's special appearance, but it has a twist, and it's the twist I'd like to focus on this afternoon. It's undisputed that Ms. Alfred Shaw is not and never has been a Texas resident, and there's no claims asserted against her. The sole basis to assert personal jurisdiction over her is in her role as the alleged executor of the estate of her late husband, Robin Dale Shaw. Of course, as I'm sure the court is well aware, the twist is this. Is Mr. Shaw's estate open or has it closed by operation of law such that she's no longer the executor? As this court has recognized as recently as 2019 in the estate of Stiegel case, an estate closes by operation of law when all the debts and claims against the estate have been paid, all of the estate's assets and property have been distributed, and there's no pending litigation or no other need for an administration. This is a proposition that's not only been recognized by this court, but it's been recognized by at least six other courts, Texas courts of appeals, and dare I say, it's as close to black letter law as you can get in the probate world.
Let me stop you there real
sure.
quick, Mr. Sanfilippo. Two questions.
Okay.
This case that's our case, you said it's a recent case. What's the date on that case, and what's the citation? Because I don't think you mentioned that in your brief.
I did not. In fact, I didn't come upon it until it was actually in the response brief, and it's in our reply. And it is a state of Stiegel, and it is the cause number is 02-17-410-CV, and the Westlaw citation is 2019 Westlaw 620-5244.
Okay.
Now, the outcome of that case was different, and you all found that the estate was still open, but it was because there was a pending claim and there was a need for, there were some issues with respect to capacity, and there was still pending.
So that was dicta, then, in that case that you're citing to, I assume, then?
It's a proposition of law laid out in that case and probably a dozen others throughout the courts of appeals. So whether or not it was ended, I don't think it was dicta in that case, though they recognized what the law was, and just under the facts of that case, recognized that the estate hadn't closed by operation of law.
Right. Well, but you will concede, I think in your brief, a direct quote would be that you're stating that this is a longstanding, I think it was, bedrock principle of Texas probate law.
I do.
But you agree that there are splits on this throughout the state when it comes to other courts, correct?
I don't know that I would agree with that there are splits when it comes to other courts. There are other courts that have looked at the facts before them and come to the conclusion that there were reasons why the estate hadn't closed by operation of law, but I think the principle itself is solid.
Okay. Well, I'm looking at this code book right here, there's three annotations.
Okay.
And you actually kind of cite to the provision of the estate code that actually made me look this up, and in that annotation there's three different citations to three different courts on the idea of when an administration is actually closed, and they're all different. They're all going in different directions. Some of them require that there actually be an order, a discharging order signed by a trial court before it can be considered closed, and then there's some courts that say that that's not true, that it can happen under operational law without some kind of final order discharging it or closing it, per se. But nonetheless, go ahead.
There is clearly the requirement of an order if you're going to follow the statutory procedures to close, but I think the cases all uniformly recognize you do not have to file the statutory provisions to close. And in fact, I think the Texas Probate Code recognizes that. I don't know if we cited that provision in the brief or not, but I'm pretty certain that the Probate Code itself says you do not have to follow those procedures, and in fact, it can close by operation of law under the case law cited in our brief. Turning to the facts of our case, Ms. Shaw, we would submit conclusively established all three elements of what you have to have an estate closed by operation of law. She submitted two declarations. In them, she set out in excruciating detail down to the cookbook and the oven mitts what property was of the estate and how it was disposed of. She stated that all of the debts of the estate had been paid, all the claims had been paid. She hadn't acted as the executor of the estate since February 8th, 2018. And since that time, property's gone. Everything that was pending at that time was taken care of, and we would submit that under the state of the case law, her declaration, uncontroverted declaration, was sufficient to establish as a matter of law that the probate estate at that time, as of February 8th, 2018, was closed. There weren't claims pending against it until September 17th, 2020, when the second amended petition was filed in the underlying case. That was the first time there were claims, and we would submit were asserted against a closed probate estate.
Had your client had any involvement, I realize not as a party, but had she been involved at all in the litigation that was going on filed by the other widow?
None.
Or the mother, I guess, of one of the decedents.
Okay. None, and there's nothing in the record to say she even knew about it. In Potter County or in Tarrant County. And again, you know, her deposition wasn't taken. Nobody engaged in any kind of written discovery or anything. So the sum total of what we know that my client knows is in her declarations that weren't controverted.
But in the estate, she had designated an agent for service.
She had designated a resident agent, as you have to do when you're a non-resident. And there's cases out there we cited in the brief. In and of itself, the registered assigning of a resident agent isn't enough to submit to jurisdiction. Now, had she done something, right? If this claim was, hey, you wrongfully distributed property, you did something wrong in your capacity, I think we have a different issue, because certainly she would be subject to specific jurisdiction for wrongful acts she took in the process of carrying out the estate. But you don't have that here. The absolute only allegation here is she is the current executor, and that's the sole basis for the assertion of jurisdiction over her.
Are there any cases out there in which, I know you've cited to the cases, including what you said about Stiegel, about informally closing an estate and having that be the same effect legally. Are there any of those cases that have involved an out-of-state executor with a Texas agent for service?
I think it was the McCall case? One of the cases involved an out-of-state trustee or executor who had appointed a resident agent, and they found that he was subject to personal jurisdiction here, but they did so because the claims that were alleged in that lawsuit were that he had done something wrongful with respect to the administration of the estate, and that's exactly the fact that isn't at issue in this case. Clearly, you know, the estate, in my mind, either the estate is open, and if it's open and has never been closed, well, she's likely the executor. Or the estate was closed by operation of law, and once it closed by operation of law, her power's terminated, and she's not the executor. And that's the only basis to assert jurisdiction over her.
Well, okay. I do have a question here on this, because I understand your whole argument and your whole brief was narrowed down to really this issue of whether it was closed and how does it affect jurisdiction. But what if it was closed, no question. What if there was an order that said it was closed? What authority do you have that can tell me, assuming I know nothing about probate law, pretend like I know nothing about it, what authority do you have that says that there's still no minimum contacts, that in essence, that it has to be ongoing? Does there have to be some kind of immediacy for, and this is more civil law stuff, but for the minimum contacts to actually be fair and be able to be such that people will feel like they may be held in a court? Or is it you know, is there a certain timeline? Is there authority that talks about that? Because there's not a lot of discussion on, well, if it was closed, how do we conclude that the trial court was wrong, even under the auspices of that, if that makes sense?
It makes sense, and if I understand the argument right, I agree with you that there's no timeline from the standpoint of, again, if she had been alleged to engage in something wrongful or the claims involved something she did, I think she's here. I think she's fair game here. But literally, she is only alleged to be the current executor. If that estate closed, she's, you know, both the probate code and I think the case law are pretty clear that her power and authority is gone once it closes. She remains on the hook for anything she did.
Because of the pleadings. So basically, yeah. Because what they pled. And that's how they referenced her. That's how she was brought into this. They didn't reference anything else. And that's your position.
The burden of negating personal jurisdiction is driven by what are the allegations in the complaint or the petition. The only allegations in this petition are she's the current executor of the estate.
But they don't say current. You can see that, right?
They say executor.
That she had been an executor.
They say she is the executor.
Okay.
You know, if she was, then that means there is no estate. And if there is no estate, you know, there's no claims against her again. So that's the
basis
of our
argument. Well, what if they had said she had been the executor in past tense? I mean, I'm being serious.
Yeah, no, I understand that.
Yeah.
Our evidence would say she's no longer the executor and she hasn't had any contact with Texas. She's never been a Texas resident. She's
what if they pled that, though? What if they had pled that she had recently been an executor of an estate administration in the state?
My position would be that our evidence conclusively negated that and they didn't have anything to controvert to go the other way on it.
Well, she had been the executor.
But there's no claims arising out of her having been the executor.
So you're saying that just by virtue of the fact that somebody out of state having at one point in time been an executor, that's not enough for specific jurisdiction?
I do not think it is. Not if the claims don't go to that contact.
Well, you would agree that there's some kind of there is a relation element. I mean, obviously that administration would not have taken place. And these lawsuits would have never been filed had there not been a plane crash that involved three people who were all integral to both lawsuits. You agree with that? You concede that, correct?
I concede, but for the fact that there was an aircraft accident, there wouldn't have been the underlying lawsuits. I mean, you know, we wouldn't be here if they would have filed suit when they filed suit in 2017 or 2018 against the estate as well, or if they would have put the estate on notice of the claims. You know, maybe we'd even, and I'm not going to concede that we'd have a different argument, but maybe if they had any evidence in the record that she even knew about the lawsuits or even knew about the potential that this claim would arise, I would still tell you it's either pending or it's not, and there, if it's not, the estate's closed, but at least you might be getting to a grayer area. But there's no evidence in this record that she knew anything about it as of February 8th, 2018, and it's not even a matter that they missed it by 30 days or they came forward 40 days. We're talking 2.5 years.
And you take issue with the appellee's definition of pending.
I do take issue with that. And I'll tell you the other thing, as of course, every time you prepare for oral argument, you realize a million things you also would have done. And one of them is I would have cited you to the Black's definition of pending, which is begun but not complete. And under anybody's definition, I think they respectfully cite you the definition of impending or potentially pending, but pending means begun, and there's nothing that it was begun on February 8th, 2018 or February 8th, 2019. You know, we get to September 2020 before there's any claims alleged against this particular state.
Let me go back to this area of the law that you assert is longstanding and a bedrock principle. And I know what you said. You said that that you don't have to close an administration. And I think the law says that. That's true. It seems to be. I don't know if it's in the probate code, but there's case law that says that. But that's not the same thing necessarily, wouldn't you agree, as saying that an administration is closed, whether it be by operational law or it was closed vis-a-vis some kind of order, through an order. I mean, those are really three different things, correct? I mean, just because there's case law that says that you don't have to close an administration, that's a different concept a different statement of law, wouldn't you agree, than whether or not something's been closed by operation of law. Do you agree with that?
The case law doesn't necessarily say you don't have to close an estate. What it says is if you don't close it formally, it is considered informally closed by operation of law. I think one or the other, everything flows from the distribution of the property and the ending of any claims pending against. Once those things occur, the authority's gone. The estate is closed and the authority's gone. To hold otherwise, I mean, what are we going to look at? We're almost approaching the point where we're going to create new law that says if somebody comes out of the woodwork after an estate has closed by operation of law, well, we're going to say it's now reopened by operation of law because this unasserted, unidentified claim has suddenly been brought 2 years, 5 years, in the case of a minor, up to 19, 20 years. And all of a sudden, someone who's gone on with their life, who's never had any contact with Texas, who thinks her deceased husband's estate is gone, is getting something in the mail saying, come to Texas, you got to defend an estate you thought was closed 18 years ago or 2 years ago.
But you do agree that, I mean, you basically, your first position that just came out of your mouth in that recitation is really two statements of law. You have the idea of you don't have to formally close an administration, but if you don't, you're stating that, and you didn't say this, but I think what you mean is that if there's no pending litigation against the estate, all estate debts and claims against the estate have been paid, and all the estate's property has been distributed, your position is, then it is, by operation of law, closed.
Yes.
You know, that's all there is to it. But you agree that when you make that statement in your brief, for example, there's no citation to any Texas Supreme Court authority, and we're being told today, obviously, that there is some kind of position in one of our cases from 2019 that kind of says that. You're not sure if it's dicta or not dicta, but it's not something that you would, you know, are you sure you would categorize that as longstanding and bedrock if there's no binding authority that tells us that this is the case?
Goes the line of authority goes back at least to 1981. It covers most of the courts of appeals, including this one, and that 2019 case I cited. I apologize that it was not in our opening brief, but it was in front of you in both the response and the reply.
Right.
And again, you know, I don't think I'd characterize it as dicta. I think you recited the law and you analyzed the case based on it, and to me that's a recognition of what the law is, and respectfully, I wish I had a Supreme Court case on it. If there's one out there, I didn't find it. But, you know, I also didn't really find anything contrary to what all these courts of appeals are holding. Oh, I'm so sorry. I apologize. My time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. Opposing counsel is right. There's a lot of language thrown around about closed as a matter of law for estates and whether or not something is considered closed. I don't think the language is clear. I don't think the case law is clear. It kind of goes everywhere. I've never had a case where there's been such a absence of case law as I have this one. I've been doing it for 25 years.
But the fact that the estates code does not have a provision that says to close an estate you must do X, Y, and Z, doesn't that sort of imply that there can be this other informal closing of an estate by operation of law?
There is, and there's also 405.012, which says you don't have to close the way we say formally in these other sections. But it doesn't say you don't close the estate. It says you don't have to do it those ways. Because if you don't, we go back to what Texas was before we established and adopted the estates code and the probate code, which allowed an independent administrator to close an estate, and before they couldn't. And one of the real big reasons why they did that is because it was causing problems in the law in other areas. For example, if property were sold and there's no indication that the estate is closed, there could still be claims pending against the estate, and that property is tied up for, like, forever. There also is things like the beneficiaries aren't given notice because the other provisions require that. If the beneficiaries aren't given notice, they don't know that they should object.
Well, assuming that what we said in Stiegel and the other cases from around the state to suggest that there can, you know, once you've distributed all the assets and there's no pending litigation and all that good stuff, assuming that that is a legal principle that we can apply, do you have any facts in this case to suggest that this estate was not closed those ways?
Right. Your Honor, the only evidence that was presented to the trial court was Ms. Offerdshaw's two affidavits, or maybe three. But they were uncontroverted, but they weren't conclusive. Those are two different things. And although opposing counsel has argued that affidavits that are clear and direct and all these other things can be considered conclusive, those are, and he cites an unpublished case from this court that says just that. But the preface to that statement of law is that it was a disinterested witness. Interested witnesses, self-serving affidavits, different standard. The trial court is not required to believe those.
But is it your position that your client had no, in the face of the affidavits, is it your position that your client had no obligation to push back on that, for instance, by taking her deposition or sending discovery?
That's correct, because it's her burden to show as a matter of law that the trial court made an error.
Okay. And did you plead anything other than she is an executor of the estate?
No, ma'am, we did not. Okay. But I would like to point the court to a couple of cases that I did not cite in my brief, and I apologize. Although the parameters of arguments regarding what the role of the minimum contacts or the role of the estate had is governed by the pleading, you may also consider the response to the special appearance in deciding that, and so could the district court. So the argument that we are limited to that one sentence that says she was the estate executor is not true, and I have and I'm embarrassed because there's a long line of cases that I just totally missed the first time. And I'll give you two. BCG versus MYR. That's 2020 Westlaw. 5987913. That's Dallas 2020 Pet Denied. And TMX Finance Holdings, Inc. versus Welcher Finance Services, LLC. 515 Southwest 3rd 1. Houston, First District, 2016, and it said Pet dismissed. I'm not real sure what that was, but that was the indication.
Well, what was stated in the special appearance then? That's where you're headed, right? I mean, with the case law.
In response to the special appearance?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm just saying the arguments were more fleshed out and that she was the estate executive,
right,
and that by virtue of it still being open, that she indeed was subject to the jurisdiction, personal jurisdiction of the court. I personally think that because Mr. Shaw committed a tort in Texas that caused a wrongful death in Texas, that the representative of his estate should be subject to personal jurisdiction no matter where she's located. But I couldn't find that anywhere in a case or a treatise or anything. So I didn't argue it. But it seems quite unfair that she wouldn't be subject to personal jurisdiction when, if he had survived, this wouldn't even be a question.
But doesn't it all hinge on whether the estate is open or closed?
I think it does, Your Honor. But again, it's whether it was considered closed versus closed as a matter of law, what does that mean? I think that the personal jurisdiction of an estate, or personal representative of an estate, has to do something to alert the probate court that she thinks it's gone. Otherwise, she can just walk away, and that causes problems, and that's usually not what we require in law. And that's why we enacted the probate code and the estates code. And although it's not directly addressed, and it does have that provision that says you don't have to follow these specific examples of the way to close it, I think there's a requirement that something be done. Now, I suggested that you could file a letter with the probate court, but you would have thought I asked for a kidney. In their reply brief, they stood on their head and said, absolutely not. That's not in the statute. Well, no, it's not.
Now, if we agree with your position and say, yes, there is something that you have to do and tell the probate court, that would be new.
It would
a new holding, right?
It would be. Okay. And I think you would be creating a new law where you just have to use your best judgment because, man, there is nothing out there on this or anything like it.
And usually when we're looking at whether or not a trial court, for example, still has jurisdiction, we're looking at it from a perspective of whether or not the trial court was able to do something that they later did, you know. And so we have a situation here that's quite the opposite of that. And but, you know, the question really then becomes, are you know, there can be instances where this could be to someone's benefit, and obviously this could be instances where they'll be to someone's detriment.
Sure.
But you're saying that you do agree with the appellant that if the estate was closed, then there's no personal jurisdiction based on your pleadings, based on the special appearance, based on?
That probably is the only basis that we alleged. So I suspect we are stuck with that one. I have thought of another problem that does come up if the probate court is not alerted, and that is, for example, here we had a tragic accident. Everyone knows people are going to be sued. And although we have been criticized for delaying the lawsuit and not filing the suit against Ms. Alford-Shaw to begin with, the statute of limitations had not run. If someone rushes to get rid of these assets and does so when there's the chance of litigation, in order to close an estate to try to get relief from liability whatsoever, that's a real problem.
But wasn't there an understanding up until Ms. Alford-Shaw was added to this litigation that RICO, the employer, had insurance coverage?
Your Honor, that's not terribly clear. But yes, they did. And I think I can say without going too far outside of the record, it wasn't respondeat superior coverage. It was for him and his acts of negligence, which to me seems strange, but I am not a coverage expert, and that's what they were told.
So in theory, they wouldn't cover the passengers if there was negligence by the operator.
Exactly.
Okay.
And that was the problem, and that was the cause for the change in pleadings. We do think that there was litigation because I don't think the fact that a claim has been filed or not filed is enough. Even if you buy the definition that pending means filed, I think there has to be a new or should have known requirement in that. Otherwise, you have a real problem with racing to the courthouse. And finally, I'll just say that the other side has argued that traditional notions of fair play and justice would be violated here. And the reasons I don't think qualify for the rare circumstances that Texas courts have recognized or federal courts have recognized as being a problem. She is older and she is sick, and that's a shame. But I don't think that exempts her from personal jurisdiction in Texas. Unless the court has any other questions, I'll cede the remainder of my time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you all.
Okay. Rebuttal.
Excuse me, I'm going to jump around over here a little bit. With respect to the uncontroverted declarations, we would submit that this falls within the scope of the testimony that the court was not within its right to just simply disregard. In addition to citing this court to its own unpublished opinions, we also cited to the City of Keller versus Wilson, which says a fact finder cannot disregard undisputed declaration that is clear, positive, direct, otherwise credible, consistent, and could have been readily converted. There's nothing readily converted here. They could have if they thought they could have tried, and we would submit that you can't just disregard that, and there's nothing to controvert it. With respect to whether or not you should consider the response to the special appearance, We don't have any problem with that. Look at the special appearance. There's no evidence in the special appearance that controverts anything she said about whether or not this estate was closed. It may flesh out the arguments as to why the parties respectively believe it is or it is not, but there's no other evidence that isn't in her declaration. The idea that she should have had to act it in some way in order for this estate to be considered closed by operation of law, we submit first of all, she did act in some way. She paid all the claims, she distributed all the property, and she did everything she had to do as an executor. With respect to whether or not she should have had to send a letter, with respect, that is the antithesis of closing by operation of law. If she had done something, she could have closed it formally. A letter, as this court has, again, in a state of Stegall, that an independent executor is not required to file notice or otherwise notify the probate court that everything's done and there's no more need for administration. None of the other court cases that we've cited had any kind of, didn't turn on whether or not a letter was sent. And as a matter of practicality in this case, again, we're not talking about a date that was missed by 7 days, 30 days. There's nothing and no evidence in the record. Nobody came forward and said, hey, if someone would have sent a letter to the court, I would have somehow found out about it. She posted notice. It's in the record at clerk's record 250. She posted statutory notice as she was required to do. So plaintiff's counsel and everybody else was on notice of the estate. If anyone should have had to send a letter to keep this thing open, it probably should have been the potential claimant to say, don't close that thing up. We may sue you one day or we may have something. And again, we'd be here arguing whether or not that meant there was a pending claim. I would still submit it wouldn't have meant there was a pending claim, but at least you might have had a gray area there that I just think does not exist. One of the statements that counsel made was, once there was an accident, everybody knows that somebody's going to be sued, and, we can sit here and guess that. We could have taken her deposition and said, did you think he was going to get sued? Did you know he was going to get sued? And this goes hand in hand with whether there should have been a new or should have known standard. Even if there was, there's no evidence in here that she knew. And I don't think you could look at it and say, well, there was a plane crash, so she should have known her husband did something and he was going to get sued.
You do agree that with minimum contacts, it's not a subjective test. You agree with that, right? This is, you look at from an objective perspective on what the reasonable person would. I mean,
I agree with that to a point, but I mean, I don't think we look at this and say, would a reasonable person have thought a claim was coming? Because I think the law is there's either a pending claim or there's not a pending claim. You could argue that a notice letter constitutes a pending claim. I'd argue it doesn't, but I don't think you can just say, well, should she have known that one day, 2.5 years later, when she's sitting at home in Kentucky, somebody might file something? I just don't think that falls within the law. So with that, unless the court has any other questions, I would just respectfully submit that the trial court's order denying her special appearance be reversed.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. Your case is submitted. The oral argument was very helpful. And, again, it's nice to have people back in our courtroom. We appreciate you coming today. Thank you.